Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.
Hey there, Clayton. How's it going today?
Hey, pretty sweet, Benny. How about you?
Well, I'm excited because today we got a new flavor on the podcast, and that flavor is spicy. And I say that because we have Miles on the podcast. And when we started the podcast, if you would have told me that the things that you talked about would be on like a company-backed podcast, I would have, well, I don't think I would have believed you. Anyway.
Yeah, well, Miles brought some really interesting topics. So one of them was the problem with self-help books, the toxic positivity and hero culture, and then the bullshitification of jobs. So these are just three topics that Miles wanted to chat about. And we had a really nice, insightful, thoughtful conversation that I'm really looking forward to sharing with the audience today.
Yeah, I love that this conversation happened. I love that you guys recorded it. And I love that we're sharing it with everyone. It's a very great example of what we have on offer and people bringing their genuine selves to work. And yeah, I'm just real excited. I can't get over how excited I am for everyone to hear this episode. So without further ado, here we go.
So welcome to the podcast. We got Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human. What we're really trying to do with this podcast is just unpack the art of being human just by talking to people that work here. So today we got Miles McHenry. Hey, Miles, how's it going?
Hey, Clayton. Thanks for having me.
So the format of the podcast, just for the audience, we just let the guests pick whatever it is that they want to chat about. Miles has given us some areas to talk about that I'm really looking forward to. But before we do that, Miles, so you've been around here for 8 years. Is that true?
Eight, going on nine now, I think. I've honestly lost count.
2015, I guess.
But yeah, I made it through one sabbatical.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about. You had a sabbatical.
It was great. Got to spend some time with the folks who live in the States and for a month.
Wow.
Good use of the time.
That is pretty sweet. So you're a product owner.
I used to be a QA back when that was still a thing in our dev teams. When I first came on, I was one of three in the ES integrations area. From there, I worked my way into release management stuff and roles. Eventually did a stint as the team lead for tech support for a year before coming back to do product owner, more or less full-time for two teams now.
How did you find this company to work for back in 2015?
Word of mouth. I was, I think I was at the time, I was pretty unhappy with the job that I had, but over the course of my time there, I built up some good relationships with contractor QAs. So good friend, or well, a coworker come good friend, had been trying to get me to leave the company for some time with, promises of a career in testing. And, he got me a job at IQ.
That's kind of an interesting origin story. You know what I think is kind of curious about this conversation is that we have two people with the background in sociology. I think that's kind of weird. I don't run
into
people.
That's right. Yeah, I don't have a formal technical or business background. I mean, I have taken. I do have an associate PMP. I've taken some business analysis courses in my own time, but that's not what I went to school for at all.
Yeah. You a U of M guy with a sociology? Is that what? Or are you from the States?
Yeah, U of M with a sociology degree. I do have dual citizenship, but oddly enough, I've never lived in the U.S.
Oh, that is quirky. Yeah, I've got a BA in sociology as well. And it's interesting. It's just a curious intersection, I think. One of the things that I think about is this proliferation of STEM, which is understandable. But then people like Mark Cuban saying, you know, what we should consider is STEAM, adding in the arts, the humanities to STEM and integrating more of the human side into STEM. Because his contention is that what we're doing is about and for people. So we should integrate a little bit more of the arts and the humanities into the technical world and the business world. But anyway, just something that I've think about. I'm not sure if you've ever thought about that, but
I think there's a great amount of value in sort of that classic liberal arts degree education that's being or has been over the last few decades really devalued in society. You really see the erosion of those programs in the universities themselves, but also kind of, I think, a loss in the general population of students today, of kind of these what used to be core prerequisites, like, you know, the ability to craft a multi-page essay, you know, the ability to do, you know, your own research and your own reasoning and come to your own conclusions in a paper, like kind of that critical thinking 101 stuff is really to our own detriment as a society, I think, that that's happening. And that's kind of part of what I'd like to talk about here today.
Good segue. Good. Let's just dive into it then, Miles. You gave me three areas. Maybe I'll just list them off. A problem with self-help books, toxic positivity, hero culture, and this emerging phenomenon of the bullshitification of jobs.
Yeah, I hope I've got enough steam and material to get to all three of those. But certainly the self-help books, business books subject, I think we can really touch on here in this time. We'll see what else we get to, because they are kind of interrelated, but.
Three of those things. A lot of ground to cover. Let's just see what we can unpack here.
Sure. Yeah. What is my problem with leadership books or self-help books?
Let's define that a little bit, just to give us a little bit of a
what is so framing. Wrong with them? There are totally valid reasons, I think, for looking through these books. And when I was starting to take leadership roles here at IQ, at the time, at least, there was a book club and some other, we'll say, like, there was a culture, there were certain books that were out there. I think, like, Radical Candor was one. There was definitely a Simon Sinek book in there too.
Start with Why.
Yeah, maybe the Start with Why.
Yeah,
I think his more famous one. You know, it's not to say that these books are good or bad, or just to assign big labels to them. I just think that there's some problems inherent. You know, number one, if that's kind of your only diet of information, but also because I think when you look at sort of the grand points that get drawn, sometimes I don't think the conclusions are backed up by the facts presented in the book. And that's, I think, inherent in the format. You know, business books aren't meant to be a thesis paper. They're not going to show you their research. They might cite some sources for you, and I think that's kind of common now. But, you know, generally, it's just implied that these conclusions that are being drawn are all 100% correct. I also think, and I mean, to what end, right? I mean, you've got these people who, like, the self-help industry is just that. It's an industry. The book, in industry parlance, is just kind of that first step into a larger career. It, you know, one book deal begets a talking show circuit, you know, your paid speaking fees, because now you're an expert. Right. So and I think that's just a real trend that you see, is people come up with their, you know, catchy title or concept. They'll cherry pick a bunch of information from all over, and, you know, with Cynic loves to pull science facts to give them that air of scientific legitimacy, right? That's it's a very common technique that you'll see. And he likes to quote all kinds of business leaders, you know, people like Jack Welch talk about how he used to do business, you know, glossing over the fact, the horrific things that Jack Welch did, both as a business leader and a person.
Miles, why are these topics interesting to you in general?
That's a great question. I think it's just really important, I think, to be, to maintain that kind of inner critic when it comes to the information that's being presented to you. We live, you know, in an information age, sure, but it's no secret that a lot of that information is, you know, at times completely false, at best, maybe just a little misleading. So people really need to be, we'll say, media literate is a word for that. Right. And that just goes to all media that you consume. It could be the advertisements on TV that I hope a lot of us are wise to. But, you know, it should also extend to, you know, literally anything that you read or hear. You should be able to, you know, break it down, challenge that. And that's hard. That's something you have to practice over the years, is your critical thinking skills and your analysis.
Yeah. In what ways do you pay attention to your media diet?
Part of it is keeping it varied. You know, I try to get it from a variety of sources, but you know, the unfortunate thing is that in this day and age, certainly here in North America and Canada in particular, you've had a real consolidation of media in recent years. And that's not even to get into the whole industry of war propaganda that exists here in North America, and certainly that we're really seeing in high gear right now with the conflicts going on in Ukraine and beyond. I think it was Ai Weiwei, the dissident Chinese artist, actually recently, somewhere earlier this month, had a statement come out. It was in an art-based publication. He was saying that the propaganda machines in the West are far more sophisticated and insidious than kind of what's seen as that obvious government propaganda that you maybe see from Russia right now or the Chinese government. So I think it's just really important to be aware of kind of that. All of that's going on, and kind of protecting yourself from it.
I do think about the importance of media diet. I also spend quite a bit of time being thoughtful about what media I consume and how. I have these little weird heuristics, like I mute commercials when I'm watching TV, for example.
Oh, yeah, that's a great habit to be in. But you do have to be on it.
Yeah, you have to be sitting there ready to go. But further than that, like you say, the diversity of media diet is something that I really strive for too. I do allocate a bit of a budget every year, a couple hundred bucks, to specifically subscribe to sources of information that aren't, well, they're independent.
Part of that mainstream circuit that's funded by advertisements and
to get out of the advertising loop. I do that intentionally. So I do a couple of things. I won't mention them because that always triggers people, but because people then make assumptions about you as an entire human based on one source of information that you use, when actually all I'm trying to do is really get diverse. One of the practices that I also really try to get into is, trying to actually incorporate media from perspectives that I just don't agree with. And so I do reading, I read books that I know Rhonda's like, why are you reading that? It's because I want to understand how people are thinking, how people are approaching this experience that they're living and the language set that they're using to construct their worldviews and the paradigms and the lenses that they look at. So I just want to be, I guess able to contribute to conversation with people when you do happen to have the ability to do that. But all of that takes effort, and it's just easier to sit in a information loop, and that gives you that confirmation bias, that little endorphin rush that feels good because you're right and all that shit. Right. But anyway, this is some of the stuff that I'm thinking about when you're talking about what you're describing, why these topics are interesting to you.
No, I think hitting it on the head. I think there's more to it though as well. Like, I think part of that building up your ability to think critically is also kind of pulling back from these harmful sources of information that would seek to manipulate you into all sorts of things, whether it's supporting the bombing of country X, or you purchasing another gas guzzling car because you think it's going to make you safer on the road. There's all kinds of agendas that people are pushing through information. Yeah. And in the case of leadership books, that's often more of a personal ego-based agenda to build up themselves into a brand, because that's what we do now in this society. Yeah. We're all trying to become brands.
What I'm curious about is, what do you think it is in us that makes this market possible?
That's a great question. We are an inherently social species. They say that creativity is taking two concepts maybe that have already existed and putting them together in a new and novel way. That's really what the creative process is all about. You're not pulling something from nothing. You're not reinventing the wheel. You're giving the wheel chrome rims and sweet treads so that it can go up a mountain. I don't know.
Right.
and so because of that, we naturally seek out advice, and we seek out people that know more than us, because of course we would. That's just the basis of why we're so successful as a species, because we can work together. And so naturally information, you know, should be shared. So there's, people just seek answers. Yeah. But I think particularly in our day and age, you know, I think even in the 1950s, people talked about the move to the suburbs becoming a social isolating factor. You had these de facto segregated communities living all kind of apart from each other, and you know, all the problems that have been described with the suburbs. But now you've got, in the advent of the internet, social media platforms and cell phones, just really seems to be driving this deteriorating of the social bonds, you know. I'm not like any the first person to talk about this, so I'm just gonna treat it as fact, and you can deal with that as you want. But I think modern society, because of where we're at with the technology and everything, has just become very alienating. COVID made that even worse for a lot of youth, especially. You got a lot of young people that just are stunted in their social development. I've had teacher friends talk about that problem quite a bit, depending on what age group they're working with.
Yeah, one of my kids is a high school teacher, so we get some feedback on that. One of the examples that come to my mind when you're talking, Miles, is I think about the effect of YouTube on my relationship with my elders. So I realized that my dad would talk to his friends or his brothers when he had a question about how to fix something in the house. That created relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
I never asked my dad anything in the last 20 years, because if I needed to change an air filter on my car, I would go to YouTube and, you know, Tony, the car guy, would tell me. And I noticed that's affected the relationship that I had with my dad, and then even currently with my father-in-law. There's a lot to that relationship that is missed by having YouTube. So there's obviously a ton of benefit to me in YouTube. But you lose something in the relationship. You lose something. Like, I imagine they lose something because they're not. There's a validation that comes when people seek your perspective, your mentorship, your guidance, and you get to pass on some of this knowledge that's kind of hard won. Like, there's a lot of bleeding knuckles that are going into learning how to fix stuff around the house or fix in the car. And that equity, that sweat equity that they put into it, used to get payoff. And it's not why you do it, but it's a natural feedback loop. You know, it's a kind of a recursive feedback loop that happens intergenerationally. And that's just one example of many that I think of when there's just pervasive information available that's a benefit. But there's also costs. There's externalities. If you took some economics classes, there's externalities to this stuff that contribute to the state of things now. And I don't mean just to be totally negative, but I do notice that. And I have to do other things to try to create relationship with people around me because that's important to me. But I do notice that these natural little things, they're just kind of gone, you know? Even headphones. I think about headphones and the age at which my kids got headphones, that's kind of the age when they went on a slightly different path than me. They didn't have to listen to my music. They didn't have to listen to my talk radio shows. They didn't. So they learned less about me, whereas I knew all sorts of stuff about my dad because of what he listened to. And then his perspectives on things. These are little, but not little things, but they're things that come to my mind when I'm listening to you share what you're sharing.
And I'm not going to quote the Unabomber, I'm going to paraphrase him, but he, you know, what his sort of central gripe was, and I think this is accurate enough, he got pretty ranty, and I don't really endorse the rest of his theory, but, you know, any technological change that happens in a society ends up, like, those consequences, you don't know them, and they get borne out decades later, and then people are trapped in that. Like, we can't go back from cell phones and the internet now. Not that I'm saying we should. There's lots of benefits to those technologies, of course, but those consequences that came with that, and that came with you know, giving social media companies free rein to create addictive products, and all the brain rewiring that's happening that we're finding out as a result of this, like, that cat's out of the bag now. That's, I think, what he was trying to get at here. And the relationship with your father, with your children, those relationships and the impacts on that, like, that's done now, right?
What I think is quirky there is the incentives, because I also look at my, you know, my retirement investments, and I want them to grow. and they're growing because, you know, in part because of these advancements of these technologies. And it's just such an intricate web that we're in, or an intricate relationship that we're in with these things, because on one hand, it's ostensibly net negative, but also upon further review, I'm investing in this stuff all the time and financially benefiting and trying to help my family benefit. Anyway, it's just, there's these complexities that as soon as I start thinking about this stuff, it's like, oh boy, there's a real complexity here that it's hard to unpack.
Yeah, it sure gets tricky. You know, interestingly enough, your relationship with your dad that you touched on there, you know, that kind of relationship is now being replaced with, you know, things like life coaching and all these services that people want to tell you. You know, not to go too hard on life coaches, but it's a completely unregulated quote unquote profession. And it's just Wild West out there. Lots of people want to take your money and tell you how to be a better person. But that, I think, is the first sign that you should maybe reconsider that, you know?
We do.
Just go out there and make friends, you know. Good friends will challenge you and push you along. You know, good parents should do that too. You could be getting this advice, I think, in a lot of cases, and that motivation from just a community of people that care about you. You just have to take the time to build that. And friendships, you know, relationships take work.
It's blowing my mind how far away that seems. Like, I'm actually thinking about what you're saying, and it's, that seems so far away from possible, from, like, as I'm putting it together. That's depressing a little bit.
I mean, you know, depending on where you live, right? Like, if you're in the suburbs, it is harder to go out and have community. I've had to go out and try and build it for myself in some cases, but I'm fortunate enough that I live in the city, so it's a little different for me.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about toxic positivity, hero culture, and just see, like, when you talk, when you're thinking about that, Miles, what are you thinking about? How do you define that, or what's the framework that you got here?
Yeah, that's great, because that does kind of tie into self-help books. So in the self-help book, the sort of the overriding theme of any self-help book is always that the onus is on you, the individual, to change, right? There's no problem in society that needs to be overcome collectively. That's not the solution. The solution is for you to just change your mindset, be more positive, look at things a different way. And that's not, you know, there's value in all of that, but seen in context, it's not going to get you out of every problem. It's not going to solve global warming or world hunger or forever war. It's going to do none of those things. It can make you, you know, happier, or, well, you know, you can tell yourself that you're happier. So, and I think that's kind of where toxic positivity comes from, is it's, you often see it in workplace organizations that are criticism adverse, that, you know, where leadership is kind of afraid to hear that. I'm very thankful that IQ is not that kind of a place. We've tried, you know, we've suffered from toxic positivity like any startup does. And I know even my team history when we were new, we engaged in a lot of, let's say, heroic work action. But to back that up and actually give a definition for people, when we talk about toxic positivity, I think we're talking about just a broader culture, typically in a workplace or any kind of social environment where criticism is generally, say, frowned upon socially. And where, as a result, you force yourself to be happy. You don't, you know, there isn't, you know, bad news is washed away or sanitized. Companies or groups don't talk about their mistakes or their losses. Everything is just a constant one note cheerleading fest. I think that may be the best. Right.
When I was reading about it, positive attitude at all times, suppress genuine emotions or emotions are invalidated. So this really lines up pretty cleanly with what you're talking about. This is actually three things I want to talk to you about. One is, do you think of these things as a binary or a continuum? Because that really deeply affects a person's reactions to things, right?
Yeah, I think most things as a continuum. So that would be my default answer.
And that's important, I think. And I knew that would be your answer. But I think a lot of people just think in binaries. And it's like, it's this or it's that. And I guess I want to be clear that it isn't. And there's a continuum that this goes along. When I look at some of the mechanisms that we try to put into place here, a culture of feedback, which is an ongoing work, it ebbs and flows. There's this idea of psychological safety, which I know currently is kind of taking a beating out there in society in some corners, but really all it is the extent to which you feel comfortable sharing your perspective with your peers. That's all psychological safety is. It doesn't mean you feel good all the time or you're happy all the time or everything's nerfed for you, which I think is the cynical view that some people, pretty famous people, like richest man in the world type of people, think of it. But anyway, there are mechanisms, you know, that we do try to integrate the human side. So, for example, in one-on-ones, our intention is for one-on-ones to be the one time where we're focusing on the experience of the person. Now, I know that isn't always what happens. It still becomes just a task list review, but we do try to create these spaces with these intentions to try to introduce this human side and try to work against this toxic positivity. But it's an ebb and a flow.
I think we have, you know, some mechanisms in place to try and keep things honest. And I think it does play out differently in different teams, which maybe I'll circle back to. But you already touched on the one-on-ones. That's a pretty good way to do it. In our internal team, we've got sort of an internal team chat where we can, you know, just speak our mind about stuff. You know, there's times where we get big news from the company that maybe we have mixed feelings about. And so we've got channels where we can hash that out in a way that, number one, I think keeps it to an audience of people that are okay with that kind of communication. And so that if somebody doesn't want to participate or see that kind of criticism, then they can, you know, stay out of it, and it's not going to affect them. So I think that's and that's, you know, partly just having the Slack channel, but also because our culture allows it. That's kind of always been my experience here on the dev teams, is that we can be open about how we're feeling, you know, these kinds of things, these thoughts.
How does that help you?
It allows us to, I think, find where the common grievance points are with something, and then sometimes that helps us push for a change, or but also just to hash out, you know, sometimes it does become a discussion rather than just a dump fest of, you know, this is bad. Sure.
Right.
You know, and there is, of course, like you said, it's a spectrum. There is the other end of toxic positivity that is also not very pleasant to be in as a working environment or otherwise, where you're just constantly dumping on, you know, whatever the stress is. And we certainly had that at one point on one of my teams where we worked for a very say, demanding, high profile client, and they had a very unhelpful blame cast. You just name it, all of these bad habits this partner who kind of managed their QA testing had, and it caused, you know, it was just a running, I think, 3-year joke about how bad this was. But at certain points, that was all it was just sour notes. It didn't change until the business relationship changed. And you know, now things are better, but yeah, it is a spectrum. You can go from one end to the other. And
I think it's so hard for people to believe that you can work with preference towards trust and respect and transparency and honesty. I don't know that I think about incentives when I think about this, but I guess what I want to ask you, Miles, is what level do you think about this at? Which is to say, like, when I think about this, it's like, well, what are the incentives to act in different ways? Like, what is it that gets people to go about their day to day, either, you know, very positive, very negative? Do you think about incentives? Like, why this is?
Human emotions are complex. Incentivized. Still not that well understood. No.
But yeah, there's people, incentives. I'm assuming there's incentives.
Everybody brings their own energy and mindset into work. And there are aspects of work that can make things stressful to a breaking point. I think if you have the right culture, or sort of to say vibe, for lack of a better term, base in your team, your home team, your area of work, that kind of helps keep you in check. So even if you come in with a bad day mindset, you know, well, at least I know that my coworkers are pretty chill. And so that's right. And it does make a difference that way. So yeah, I think maintaining that culture or whatever it is, our je ne sais quoi at IQ here, where we try to walk that middle road. So we're neither a dump fest nor toxically positive.
Yeah.
But yeah. It doesn't mean we're perfect at it.
No. Do you have a sense of how that's attempted here? How would you describe how we attempt to walk that road?
I mean, as far as I've seen, it's generally been a bit of carte blanche for people to sort that out. I think IQ kind of bakes it in by, sorry, policy of not hiring assholes. I feel like that's kind of the key is you want reasonable people. I don't like the concept of hard labels where one person is just an asshole for their whole life and another person is a reasonable person their whole life. I myself was once a huge asshole. So, you know, like, people change and evolve over time, but I think it's important to bake in people who are at a point in their life where they can have complex conversations, entertain two contrasting ideas at the same time, be able to bring that higher level thinking to the space. I think that's really what the secret is. And the rest is more hands off with a little bit of, you know, facilitating here and there. I mean, I've seen, higher ups pop into a public Slack channel and say, hey, let's cool it from time to time. But
Yeah, I almost never get to have conversations like this, and
you gotta get out of the house, dude.
okay, I'll take that as the truth. Anyway, I've been in my house for 4 years. Well, let's look at this idea of bullshitification of jobs. So, you know, what I'm curious about this is, you know, what's the kind of broad strokes of how you're thinking about this? Like, how do you know it when you see it? How do you describe it? Why do you think it matters?
Bullshit jobs was initially a long article, and then eventually became a best-selling book by anthropologist who's now deceased, Dr. Graeber, David Graeber. Wonderful book. Great analysis. And he's an anthropologist, so it's a bit of a different take than, say, like a pop sociology book. David Graeber solicited a bunch of input from people on the premise that what we're seeing in recent decades was a proliferation of what he called bullshit jobs. A bullshit job is defined as a work activity, ostensibly work activity, or job that adds little to no social value, and in fact is often sort of, because of that in non-utility to society, actually detrimental to the people that perform it psychologically. Mm-hmm. He talked about, you know, there's in some cases you have entire bullshit jobs, and in other cases you have what's referred to as the encroaching or the bullshitification of jobs, which is what you see sort of with the changes in academia that have happened in the last, I want to say 30, 40 years, mm-hmm. where you've had financial interests really step up and begin to manage universities so that rather than working on developing course frameworks or teaching their students, you've got professors mm-hmm. who have to spend increasing amount of times filling out paperwork to justify grant money to there's all these evaluations for how well you're teaching, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. So they're spending more and more time on those kinds of activities every year, and less on actually being good professors to their students. And that's, I think for him, that was the red flag that, maybe this is happening in other places.
Yeah.
And he solicited a bunch of that information or feedback, rather anecdotal evidence, rather from people to tell their stories. And he got lots. The book is full of some really great ones. In the tech industry, we see this a lot of times when we talk about like contractual obligations.
Yeah.
You know, we can talk or like, I think it, for us as a company to stay certified as being security compliant, everybody has to take those little e-learning videos that are incredibly condescending to anybody that has any amount of technical knowledge. I get it. We got to check the box, keeps us certified. It adds, you know, for the company, there's a strategic reason that we do this.
Yeah.
But for everybody that's got to spend 5-15 minutes out of their day doing it, boy, do they fucking hate it.
500 people. 15 minutes. Are you a libertarian, Miles? Is this what I'm reading?
No. No.
What's happening here? Don't tell me what to do.
I'm a hard socialist. No, I just don't being condescending. You know, it just feels incredibly patronizing and condescending the way that that information is presented to us.
Yeah.
Year after year after year.
I don't want to argue with you too much, but it does seem like a very subjective position. Like there are people there's a subjectivity to what you're describing, which I, you know, it's inherent to humans, but
Here's the thing. I'm sure there's people where that's news to them and great.
Yeah.
That's, you know, these are educational videos after all.
You know what I just did there, Miles, is something I don't like. And that is I push back on your anecdote when you're actually talking about a statistical societal thing. And you gave an example and I push back on that, which is a mechanic in discussion that I think is weak. And I wish I hadn't done that. So let's kind of back up here. No, it's not fine. I think it's an absolute bullshit weak way to talk with people. And I think it's a heuristic that we see that makes it exhausting to try to have conversations with people across the aisle, so to speak, because they ask you for an example, you provide one, and you're having a statistical discussion, like a societal discussion level discussion, which isn't anecdotal. And then they say, well, give me an example. And okay, so you do. And then they push back and defeat on or beat that up and think that they've destroyed your whole position. And it's like, that's not what we're doing here. Anyway, I just wanted to call out what I just did there, and I just think that's brutal. Anyways, let's that's what bullshitification of jobs. That's how you identify it, and that's the Graeber is the reference point there. What do you why is this important to you?
For me personally, I've always been all about efficient processes and not spending time in an unnecessary meeting. I'm kind of famous for declining on meetings that I don't think add value. If I'm invited to one where I'm not going to contribute, I don't show up. It's not worth my time. But in that same vein, then, if there are activities or parts of my day-to-day job that don't add value to anybody other than allowing someone to maybe check a box to say, well, that was done on this process that we have written out that we just stop questioning. If we allow that stuff to proliferate unchecked, then that's going to slowly eat up the time that you spend on your job. And then I'd have to spend, you know, if I don't continue to challenge these things as they come up or question, why am I doing this activity? Why am I going to this meeting? Then eventually I'm not going to have any time left for my real job. Or the things that are important for me as a product owner to keep my teams going, right?
Wow.
That's the real central thing, is if we just allow these activities to continue to grow. You know, when I took on release management, there was just so much unnecessary paperwork that I think the previous people who had had that role had come up with over the years. You know, everything was being documented in multiple places. You had a release copy of a release plan that was client appropriate, went out to our client. You had a copy of the release plan that was internal and it went out internally. You had it tracked. And then like updates from that went into another sheet. Anyways, and so I just stopped doing that. I blew out everything that wasn't relevant. Right. I started recording everything in one place for, you know, single audience or all audience, uni audience consumption. And, you know, it's just that kind of stuff. I've got another example where I have a client meeting every 2 weeks where we should be discussing roadmaps and delivery plans. And as part of this, I prepare a slide deck of just what our development team has been working on that's custom to this client. And half the time they don't show up. So there's a good argument to be made that, you know, those slides are partially, you know, working on them is bullshit. I don't actually think the clients look at them if they are not being presented. I send them out as a copy after, but it's, you know,
right.
As far as I know, that's just getting lost in the ether.
Yeah. You know, when I listen to what you're talking about, Miles, just to what one of the things that you're making me think about is there's this constant tension between, like, so institutionalizing knowledge, which is to say the day-to-day experiences that each of us have, to avoid getting into heroic situations where the answer to a problem is a person who, hey, I got this problem. Oh, Miles. No. To advance and scale as a company, I think, and I'm happy to be wrong here, Miles, I'm just giving you my thoughts, but I'm happy to have you push back. I think that the part of the evolution is to institutionalize that knowledge from the person into practices and procedures and that scale. So there's that desire, right? But then there's this, but then it gets, as it goes too far, it seems like this is what you're talking about, where there's these dogmatic, seemingly arbitrary things that happen just because they've always happened. And people don't take the agency to critique them and say, should I do this? Well, they just, you know, and so I think what we're, as a company, one thing that we try to advocate for and create space for is for agency and autonomy to emerge within a person, because they are deeply aware of what's going on around them. What do my stakeholders need? Myself, my team, the company, my clients. And through that, then coming back to what you started with at the beginning, was the ability to critically think, I don't think this is useful, and push back on these things. You know, no agenda, no attenda. I'm not coming to your meeting. This process seems arbitrary. I'm going to test it. Whereas, and that seems like a very empowering, enabling, energizing way, and a way to avoid this stuff that you brought as topics to talk about, which is heroics, toxic positivity, just accept everything and it's great. But also, furthermore, this bullshitification of jobs. It's like, this is a picture, a narrative that's emerging in my mind as you're talking. What's your reaction to my narrative?
I think you're right on the money. I think that is kind of how I envision these topics connecting back to each other. I know we didn't really touch much on hero culture. I feel that, you know, out of all the topics, that doesn't need so much introduction, because we're all kind of familiar with it here at IQ.
Right.
Various levels we've all had to play that hero. Yeah. You know, I remember coming in on a Sunday in a state, we'll say, because I'd been partying up the night before, not a lot of sleep, but somebody needed to come in and test this physical card machine for a payment integration for an urgent bug fix that had to go out to our top clients. So, I'm fully aware of those things. We've moved away from that a lot. I think what you talked about, where you rather than have things become just an individual activity, it's a team process, right? You shift accountabilities to maybe a rotating basis if they're special. We've started to do that with, I mean, the most obvious example is QA. What happened with QA, where rather than the testing residing on one person, we did away with the role, and now most developers test each other's work.
Right.
On my team, we started to do that with the release manager role. It used to be just one person to handle all of the coordinating, is now once a month, it's a new developer, one of our teams, and that's been going pretty good. Helps them get comfortable with another aspect of the work. And also, like you said, makes us more just protected and as a team, people go on holiday.
My thesis there was that I feel like there's things that we try to do procedurally or as a mindset that try to inoculate us against some of these things that you're talking about getting deeply embedded in the culture. We still, you know, any company suffers from these things, us notwithstanding. But that seems like a hopeful note. Am I being too hopeful here? That we have some ways to inoculate? Am I deluding myself? Or
hope is a crutch. We shouldn't. Don't let hope see things for what they are, whether that's bad or good. I think the threat of the bullshitification of jobs is just ever encroaching, and it comes from different sources, right? Not everything is because we signed a contract that stipulated we were going to maintain this kind of certification, and therefore we all have to fill out form C-53, whatever, once a year. Yeah. You know, that some of those things, unfortunately, we're just going to have to bite the bullet on and deal with, right? Like the security videos, we just got to deal with it. It's fine.
Re-signing those documents every year.
Right.
And it takes like 5 minutes, but I'm just like, what?
It's another thing on the to-do list, right? Some of those things, inevitable. But I think what you had described previously, where it's the bullshit activity is just the result of, this is just the way we did it or do it, or that's the way the last person did it, cargo cult kind of thinking. You know, you can identify that, you can change that. You can, if you have, you know, if you see it for what it is and you can think of a better way to do things, then those are, you know, maybe that's where you could be, you know, you can be hopeful enough and fight that. But we'll see what the future holds. I'm less optimistic.
I guess what I was trying to describe there is that you are evidence of the fact that in this environment, we try to push that agency and autonomy to the individuals to look at these things and call bullshit and say, or just push back and just say, So we create space for people to be critical, to be thoughtful. And it doesn't mean like anytime you bring up a concern, we'll do it different. But at least you know that you're going to be trusted and respected to be heard, which is psychological safety. And then through that, you get the clarity, a change is made or it isn't, but you have the clarity and you understand why. I think the beautiful part is that more things move within your locus of control here as you accept the agency and autonomy that is offered.
That does sound right to me. Just from my experience here at IQ, I know I have a reputation for being kind of vocal and critical, and I've never had professional repercussions because of it. So to that end, I think IQ does a good job of trying to foster that kind of a climate.
Miles, when you accepted my invitation to talk here and you picked these topics, what was your hope? Boy, now you've poisoned that word for me here. How are you envisioning us landing this plane? What were you hoping the audience would understand, or what was your intention? Just anything.
I just think it's really important in this day and age that people really understand the value of the critic or being a critic, or why you shouldn't just take everything you're told at face value, right? There's a Terence McKenna quote that I've got here. I think the important thing is to reclaim your mind, get it out of the hands of the cultural engineers who want to turn you into a half-baked moron consuming all this trash that's being manufactured out of the bones of a dying world. I don't think I did that justice in the reading, but, you know,
wow.
The point is there, and he was right. You really got to be careful who you're getting your information from. And that's not to say, you know, that you're not going to find something of value in a self-help or a business book. But also, I don't think you're going to find, you know, that much mind-blowing content either. And I think the fact that a lot of these books can get summarized into a page write-up on Blinkist, whatever those apps are.
I subscribe to Blinkist, and it's here's the Blinkist 10 things.
If you could condense, you know, those seemingly complex ideas into a quick little one-page summary, then I feel like maybe it's not worth spending the money on the book in the first place. But,
you know, Miles, I'm actually thinking about the utility of something I said earlier, which I don't I feel like I'm tooting my own horn here, but actually is more apropos to say, you know, I was saying my media diet. And if you think about a diet, it's just you collecting nutrients and macros and calories from a variety of sources to, you know, so your body can construct the cells. But I actually feel much better about my choice of language there after talking with you for an hour, because it is useful to have a broad diet. It is useful to have a diverse set of sources. And I just feel like I unintentionally really aligned pretty cleanly with kind of the theme that, or the thesis that you are advocating for.
Broad diet is great, but I think in the same way it works with nutrition, you know, focus on good, healthy content.
Right.
The perfect analogy for that in media, but yeah, avoid the overpriced, trashy McDonald's stuff if you want. The more you consume that, it will manifest in your thinking, in your speech, if you're not careful.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. I have always found you to be a fascinating person, and just the way your mind works, what you're choosing to pay attention to, how you're integrating information into a worldview. I've always found you a fascinating person, and today, no exception. So thanks for your time. I can't thank you enough. And I hope that you got when you think about what we've talked about, that you were able to share in a way that was useful and meaningful for you. But
no, I think if it's useful to at least one other person, then, you know, we did something good.
Hey, can I do the typical 5 questions at the end of a podcast?
Sure. Yeah, why not?
Are you up for that? In a sentence or two, what are you nerdy about?
Right now, plants, occult spiritual techniques, psychedelics.
What about, what books are you reading right now? What's a book you're reading right now?
That's a great question. I just finished Entangled Life, which is a great one, about mushrooms and mycology and just sort of the latest science behind or in that field now that's emerging. It's really awesome.
How about time travel? If you could travel ahead to see your future family, or into the past to see your past family, what would you prefer?
I'm not having kids, so I don't know that there's any point in going to the future. I mean, even if I was, I feel like you'd have to skip a good 100,000 years of whatever the next dark age we're about to enter is. So maybe we'll just say past, because that seems safer.
How about the trope of what animal would you be and why?
Yeah, you know, dolphins seem to have it pretty good before we fucked up the ocean too bad. So, like, you know, dolphin in the past. Yeah.
Yeah. 1950s dolphin.
1950s.
Thanks for putting up with those. They're pretty silly. But I always like to do it. Anyways, man, thanks a lot.
And, yeah. Thanks for your time, Clayton.
Appreciate you.
Okay, and we're back. And so that was Clayton talking to Miles about a lot of things. And I, again, can't stress how much I appreciated this conversation. Not that I don't appreciate all the other conversations, but there's a certain je ne sais quoi to this one. There's a rawness to it that happens that I think is great. And, you know, I got a lot out of it. To me, if I had to say it, I think Miles is a pretty good example of self-organizing. How did I get there? Let's ask Clayton what he thinks.
Well, I think what's neat about the example that Miles laid out for us in that conversation is just how important it is to question things and to not just take things at face value. And then, you know, each of us in a self-organizing environment has to see ourselves as a sensor of what's going on. And I don't mean censorship. I mean sensing what's happening in the environment and then having the psychological safety to bring that back to the group and say, hey, I'm noticing this, without being made to feel diminished or silly or stupid or something else. That is the secret sauce of an environment around self-organizing. People will not go out, notice things, and bring them back to the team if those things aren't heard, if those things don't have some value to the team. So Miles is just a wonderful example of a person who looks critically at the world, is curious about what's going on around him, and he wants to share. He's comfortable sharing that. And he doesn't need to be right. He's just observing. He's sharing. And I found it really refreshing, insightful, and he's a great example of what we would call a feedback loop. Go out in the environment, see what's going on, bring it back to the team.
Actually, on a personal note, Clayton, this is the first time we've ever done the podcast with someone that I really don't have a relationship with in the company. What I really appreciate about this is, after listening to this episode, I feel like if I ran into Miles somewhere, I could go sit down with him and have a conversation and fully understand what he's about and, you know, and kind of just get into it and skip all the small talk stuff, which is great. And also, you know, if I was looking for someone to start the revolution, then maybe there's Miles. On that note, thanks for hanging out with us, everyone. We really appreciate it. As always, if you have any thoughts, comments, or concerns, please feel free to reach out to us. Let us know. If you want to be a guest on the podcast, absolutely reach out to us and we'll arrange that. Or here's another thing, just a thought. If you think you'd really like to have a conversation with Clayton, but you don't want to be on the podcast, good news. Clayton's a coach, so you can go to Clayton for coaching. That's a thing that's on offer. Sorry, Clayton, I just volunteered your services to the company.
Love it.
But anyway, all right. Well, with that, we'll catch you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.